From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel, along with my colleague, Rick Pantaleo. Our special guest on this edition of the program is George Leonard, Chief Scientist for the Ocean Conservancy, a nonprofit environmental organization that focuses on the health of the world's oceans. In February, George flew to a remote island nearly 2,000 kilometers off the coast of Southwest Africa, in St. Helena, to research the effects of plastics on marine life and the ocean environment. Then in March, he took part in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's 6th International Marine Debris Conference. And so we're basically talking about trash.
Lots of it, too.
Welcome, George Leonard, to the program.
Thank you, Rebecca. Rick, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Well, first, I'm very curious to know why St. Helena, such a remote part of the world, to study plastics when you can basically find plastics anywhere on the planet, especially on our shorelines.
It is true. You can find plastic pretty much everywhere in the ocean nowadays. We were at St. Helena because we had an opportunity to do some research there with a colleague of ours, Dr. Al Dove, who's the Vice President for Conservation and Research at Georgia Aquarium. And he studies whale sharks. And at Ocean Conservancy, we focus on plastics. And so we were there to understand more about whale sharks and to understand just how bad the plastics problem might be on St. Helena and what we might do to improve it if it was a problem.
But why whale sharks in particular?
So whale sharks are a fascinating animal, marine animal. They are the largest fish in the sea. They're called whale sharks, but they're not whales. They're actually sharks. And they filter feed the water. They eat by filtering small animals, small fish, and phytoplankton and zooplankton at the very bottom of the food web. And because plastic in the ocean is often in these very, very small particles, there's this increasing worry that animals like whale sharks and some other fish and other whales can actually filter this material out of the ocean and become impacted by plastics, basically through the way they feed.
And we're talking about marine debris and plastic. And is there a difference between problems with plastics and problems with marine debris altogether?
Well, sometimes they're used synonymously. Marine debris is kind of a catch-all phrase for anything that's sort of human-made or related that ends up in the ocean. So it can be things like tires and license plates and a whole variety of things. Much of the conversation now is focused on plastics in particular, because 80% of the marine debris that's in the ocean is plastic in one variety or the other. So we typically focus on plastic pollution rather than marine debris kind of writ large.
How much plastic is dumped into the ocean each year? Do you have an idea?
So at present, we think there's about 8 million metric tons of plastic that comes into the ocean every year. That's equivalent to about one garbage truck full of plastic being dumped into the ocean somewhere around the world every minute. So it's a pretty large number. At Ocean Conservancy, we facilitated a scientific working group a number of years ago that published that work in Science, which is one of the most prestigious journals out there, received a lot of attention and has really focused much of the conversation on where that material is coming from, which is mostly from land, and most of it is coming, about half of it is coming from half a dozen countries in Southeast Asia. And so there's a renewed effort here to focus on waste management, which is really at the heart of the problem in that part of the world, to sort of stem the tide into the ocean.
You know, I recently heard a public service announcement, a PSA, as we call them in radio, about plastics. And I thought about, well, here in the United States, there's a heightened sense of urgency about use of plastic and what it does to the environment, what it does when you ingest it, and how it can get into our wildlife that we are also, you know, hunting and fishing. So how are you getting the word out to other parts of the world, especially to regions where maybe somebody doesn't live by the shoreline, maybe they're not, you know, there's not that same kind of concern, yet they're still using plastics?
Yeah, well, at Ocean Conservancy, we have for 30 years now organized the International Coastal Cleanup, which has become the largest volunteer effort on behalf of the global ocean. And every September, the third Saturday in September, people from all over the world now come out in lots of countries, up to 150 countries and states, everywhere from North America to South America through Europe and into Southeast Asia and Australia. That's one major way that we kind of get the word out there about plastics. The other is you made reference to this International Marine Debris Conference that just took place in San Diego. The last time NOAA organized this, I think 6 years ago, there were maybe 200 people that attended, and they had plenty of open seats. This time, there were 600 or 700 people that attended. They were sold out well in advance, and most of the people at that conference were not from the U.S. So this issue has really become an international issue, and people are really beginning to take notice and work together on solutions.
I'm curious about, you had mentioned that most of the plastics and debris come from the land. What's the cycle and what's the mechanism of plastics and marine debris winding up in the ocean?
There are really sort of two fundamental pathways by which plastic and marine debris end up in the ocean. The first is sort of littering proper. If you throw your material into the storm drain or out the window of your car, that material can end up in a culvert somewhere and then wash into the ocean. Globally, we think that littering accounts for about 2% of the problem. Mm-hmm. So it's a not insignificant number, but it's relatively small. The other 98% is really associated with countries and their waste management systems, which is kind of the formal or informal way that material is should be collected and disposed of.
So in other words, there are countries that are actually dumping plastic in the ocean?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a shock for many people in the U.S., maybe less of a shock for listeners around the world. But there are lots of places in the world that don't have formal collection. If they do have formal collection, they often are open pit dumps mm-hmm. in which material can leach out or flow out or otherwise kind of find its way back into the environment. But in some places, because they don't have a formal system, people will end up, you know, dumping material at the edge of town or into waterways and creeks and rivers. And as a result, the material does end up in the ocean.
And of course, coastal waterways of Africa, very big on fishing. Some people live on subsistence fishing. How important is this to countries or coastlines in a place like Africa where fishing is their livelihood?
So I think this is an issue in pretty much every coastal community in every coastal town, whether you rely on fish or not. But it is particularly the case for those countries and those communities that depend on fish. If those countries are also associated with places that don't have a lot of waste management infrastructure, you can end up with a lot of material in the environment. And the reason it's an issue is because plastic, which comes in, say, as a bottle or a bag, you can think of these big materials, will end up breaking down and fracturing into smaller and smaller pieces. So as the pieces get smaller and smaller, animals who can mistake that for food will end up eating it. And so it ends up in the kinds of animals that we as humans consume. And so right now we think that about 30% of the fish that are being consumed have plastic in their stomachs. And at present, the jury is very much out in terms of whether this is a direct threat to human health. Mm-hmm. I think the worry is there. Scientists are worried about that. And slowly the scientific community is sort of building a case here that not only is the ingestion of plastic bad for the fish themselves, but it's probably bad for humans as well.
But it's not necessarily the fault of people in certain coastlines. They can actually, my understanding is that they can actually have plastic that comes from, you know, thousands of kilometers away, not necessarily people on their beach throwing trash away or throwing it in their streams, which dumps into the ocean. You know, it could come from Asia, for example.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And in fact, coming back to the St. Helena trip that we took, that was precisely the sort of question we were trying to address, right? So here was an island. It's one of the most remote islands in the world. It's located 1,000 miles off the coast of Western Africa. And we were there to try to understand just how much material are on their beaches and to what extent that's a locally produced problem or to what extent St. Helena is sort of the end of the line here and is subjected to materials coming from elsewhere. And what we discovered was the waste management system in St. Helena is quite sophisticated. It's as a British territory. They've made some pretty major investments in their system in the last 10 years or so. And so we don't think that much of what's on their beaches is actually coming from the local populace. But because of where they're situated in the South Atlantic and the way the winds blow, a lot of material is coming from offshore. And a lot of that is fishing related. There's a lot of ropes and buoys and light sticks, a variety of things from offshore, probably foreign fishing vessels is what we think. And then there's a whole sort of ton of water bottles and other materials that are branded that have languages that are not English and corporate brands that are not sold in the local marketplace in St. Helena. So we know that those are coming from elsewhere. But it is absolutely true that you can solve your own marine debris problem locally, but still have a problem because it's coming from elsewhere.
You were talking about marine debris plastics winding up being washed into the ocean through the streams and through the beaches and so forth. But there's an opposite effect where marine debris, plastics wash onto the shore. So these people who may have meticulous, beautiful shores, pristine shores, all of a sudden loaded with plastic, loaded with garbage.
Yep. Oceanography, that is the currents and how they flow, has a huge effect on where materials end up. Your listeners may have heard of the gyres, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, as it's referred to. In the world's ocean, there are five different gyres. These are basically large circular flows of water, which is basically driven because the Earth rotates on its axis. It's sort of basic physics and astronomy. It's sort of a fascinating topic. And in those gyres, those are areas in which plastics tends to accumulate. These are also known as the doldrums. There's very little wind there. And a fascinating study was just published a week or so ago, identifying that there's more plastic in those gyres than we thought. And interestingly enough, about half of that is actually fishing gear. It's not consumer plastics, which suggests that if we're talking about keeping plastics out of the ocean writ large, we need to both solve the consumer side of this in terms of the kinds of materials that we're using, the throwaway plastics. But we also have to work with the fishing industry to make sure that we keep the fishing nets out of the ocean as well.
And that's those garbage patches we hear
that's
about
right.
or read about.
That's right.
And what happens in the garbage patch? So the plastics do not break down, or they break down so slowly that it's an eyesore. But can this cause what's referred to as a dead zone? Is it more than just ingesting the plastic?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways that plastic impacts marine life, and one of them is to be ingested, and that's typically when the fragments are quite small, although large whales can ingest big pieces of plastic and fishing gear. But the other major way is through entanglement, and this is where fishing gear has its biggest impact. Fishing nets are designed intentionally to catch fish, and if they're lost or discarded in the ocean, they can continue to catch fish or to entangle large marine mammals like whales and sea turtles. You mentioned dead zones. Dead zones is a whole other issue. At Ocean Conservancy, we try to work on the biggest threats to the global ocean. And our top three are plastics, overfishing, and the third is climate change. And climate change is looming as sort of the biggest long-term threat to the oceans. And one of the ways this is manifesting is in the coastal zones, when water is warming because of global warming and often becoming stagnant. You combine that with nutrient input from the land, nitrogen and phosphorus from agriculture, and in those cases you can get dead zones, and those dead zones basically can kill all the life that's under the surface. And in the U.S., the Gulf of Mexico is really the poster child for a dead zone, but there are dead zones all over the world, and they've been rapidly growing in size and number over the last, say, three decades or so.
You were talking about the garbage patches. I guess the most well-known one is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Tell us about that. Just how big is it? I understand it's really grown in size recently.
Yeah, so the best known is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It was discovered by Charles Moore a number of years ago, 20 or 30 years ago now, when he was sailing through it. And then it has become an active area of research, and it also has sort of grown in the public's eye in terms of what this place is like. And there are lots of ways that it's described, many of which are not really scientifically accurate. So it's referred to as, twice the size of Texas, right? Or a floating island of trash. Much of what's out there is very, very small flecks of plastic. It's less an island and it's more like a plastic soup. And the materials are still relatively sparse, right? It is a big ocean, but when you sample for it and concentrate it, that there's, the scientists, they're still working on this, but probably 280,000 metric tons. There's quite a bit of plastic out there, and, it captures the public's attention, even though the public is likely never to find themselves in the central Pacific.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest today is George Leonard. I am Rick Pantaleo, along with Rebecca Ward. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. And here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Nelson Nia Zali from Monrovia, Liberia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com and check us out on Facebook, like us, and we really appreciate that. I have another question about the Great Garbage Patch. Since it seems to be top of consciousness when you think about marine debris, marine waste, it paints an image in your mind that you got this huge island of garbage, basically. So you were kind of alluding it prior to the break here, but are we talking about a compacted area of just trash, or what's it?
Well, one of the reasons it's so large, right, is because it's not compacted, mm-hmm. right? So the way the oceanography works is there's a large swirling mass of water that's, you know, hundreds of miles across that has higher concentrations of microplastics and fishing gear than other areas. But the way to sample this, often if you sail your sailboat out, right, and you fly a drone up over the sailboat and kind of look out over the sea, it looks like, in large measure, a large, beautiful blue expanse of water. So you sort of say to yourself, well, where's the garbage patch? So the way scientists understand this problem is they tow nets behind their vessel that has a very, very small mesh size in it. So think about maybe the coffee filter at home, right? That kind of mesh. And if you tow those behind a boat for 20 or 30 minutes, you'll end up coming up with, you know, sort of a cup's worth of concentrated microplastics. Right. The new study we were talking about that came out about a week or so ago used a different technique. They actually flew airplanes over this area and then took a series of photographs throughout the whole area and then came back and used computer algorithms to sample for the large plastics that were out there, greater than 5 centimeters, so bigger than maybe the size of your hand. And most of that material is the fishing gear that wasn't thought to be common in the gyre and is now recognized to be a major part of what's out there.
Does the garbage patch remain in one place, or does it move around? Where does it go?
Yeah, so it's sort of stuck there, right? Because you've got this swirling mass of water driven by the global circulation in the ocean. It moves around a bit. It kind of, you know, left and right. But what's remarkable about this is you can pretty predictably know that it's going to be there.
Let's talk about another subject that I have read about on your blog, and that is ocean acidification.
Yes.
So what exactly is that?
So ocean acidification is a bit of a mouthful, but it is
It is for me.
And for everybody else. We shorten it to OA a lot. Ocean acidification. So there is this chemistry in the world's oceans, and it has remained largely stable, certainly in the recent past, and as long as 800,000 years ago or so, the pH of the ocean has been pretty stable. The problem is, as we push more and more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide dissolves in water, and when it dissolves in water, it changes the chemistry of the water, it changes the pH of the water. And it's making the ocean more acidic. The acidity of the ocean has increased about 30% since pre-industrial times in about the 1750s or so. And that's a greater change than has happened in somewhere between 800,000 and 10 million years. So this is well outside the normal bounds, and it's moving much more quickly than it ever has in the past. The problem with changing the chemistry of the ocean is, if you think about it, if you're an animal, everything from the smallest plants and animals to the largest blue whale is in some way dependent on the chemistry of the medium, right? The water in which they live. And so it's having ocean acidification is having a dramatic effect kind of throughout the ocean food web, but particularly those species that make shells, because the chemistry is such that it changes the availability of calcium, and calcium is the critical building block of shells. So it's a fascinating sort of science experiment that's happening out there, but it's well outside the bounds of normal variability, and it's having an impact not only on the animals, but the human communities that depend on those animals as well.
Is it changing the behavior of the animals? You mentioned the shellfish in particular. Is it changing their movement? I read a little bit where they have found sea creatures in areas where they don't particularly are known to inhabit.
Yep.
Would that be acidification?
So that's also part of the problem with climate change. So climate change is having two major impacts on the ocean. The first is ocean acidification, which is changing the chemistry. The other is that the water is actually getting warmer, which as a marine biologist, I sort of thought was fascinating. I remember taking physics classes and learning about basically how liquids take up heat. If you think about boiling water on your stove, right, mm-hmm. you need to turn the heat up for a long time to get that pot to boil. So if you think about the global ocean, which is something like 1.5 million cubic kilometers, right? Talking quadrillions of gallons of water. I found it shocking that the global ocean temperature could actually increase as a result of climate change. Well, it turns out that it can. And we've done enough science now, we've taken enough measurements to know that, the global average temperature of the water is slowly and inexorably increasing. It's about a tenth of a degree per year over time is increasing. And so this is having big impacts on marine life, in particular those fish that live within a certain temperature window. If the water gets too warm, they move out of the way. And so we've now been able to detect that fish often will move north because it's cooler to the north or to the south, right, away from the equator, and often are now moving into deeper water. And those two drivers, temperature and acidity, are having big impacts on, the health of the ocean.
You had mentioned that climate change seems to be the big driver of ocean acidity and warming of the oceans. Does the debris play a role? Are there any other factors that are affecting the acidification of the oceans and its temperature?
So acidification is largely a CO2 problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the basic chemistry of that issue is what's driving acidification. But I think your question is getting at this issue of, we know that there are multiple stressors to mm-hmm. the ocean. And so are we worried as scientists and conservationists about the kind of combined effects? And the answer is absolutely. Increasingly, we're worried about what's called in the trade sort of synergistic effects. Right. So if you take one part of overfishing and one part of debris and one part warming, do you end up with an ecosystem change that's greater than the sum of the parts? And there is increasingly evidence that these things aren't just additive, but they're actually multiplicative, right? That you get a bigger problem when they all act together. So at Ocean Conservancy, we're doing a range of work with our scientific colleagues to better understand that problem, working with folks at Oxford University, Stanford University to really do some basic science on that. And then at the same time, we're trying to think about, okay, our management structures, which are usually designed to deal with one of these at a time, how can we reform our ocean management so that we can deal with the collective challenges that, these synergistic effects create?
You mentioned overfishing. That's something we haven't really talked about. And it's a big problem, again, in many parts of the world, including the United States. How are you getting cooperation from countries that don't see it as big of a problem as we do? Or as the Western world does.
Yeah, I mean, overfishing is a fascinating topic, and we could spend a whole hour on overfishing. I grew up in New England. I grew up in Massachusetts, and I ate a lot of swordfish as a kid. And I noticed that the fish got smaller and smaller on the plate over the years. And, of course, this was before I knew anything about oceans and science. And I kind of saw the pattern, but I didn't really quite know what was going on. And years later, when I went to graduate school and started understanding and learning about things like overfishing, I realized, that the North Atlantic swordfish was being overfished. And, of course, that population crashed and swordfish came off the menu. And there was a big move to get chefs to stop selling swordfish. And North Atlantic swordfish is a good example of what can be done, particularly in developed countries like the U.S., when people rally around reducing fishing pressure and giving fish a chance to recover, because fish are kind of like weeds. If you leave them alone, they will replenish themselves. But the key is you've got to reduce that fishing pressure. So in places like the U.S., we've done a good job at reducing fishing pressure historically since about the mid-70s. It's taken a lot of work at places like Ocean Conservancy. We have an entire fish program that has worked to improve the fishery management system in the U.S. That's very different than in much of the developing world, where just like we have kind of lack of waste management infrastructure that's resulting in plastics coming in the ocean, we often don't have rigorous and sophisticated and kind of modern-day fishery management. So as the problem, overfishing is generally greater in that part of the world. And increasingly, there are worries about illegal and unreported fishing, which can be as much as half of the total take globally, is done without regard to whatever the laws are, and in many cases use slave labor and have other sort of socioeconomic impacts. So overfishing is a big topic. It's a complicated topic, but it's one I think that actually consumers, we haven't talked about consumers yet, but what individuals can do here. And seafood is a great example of how people can have a big impact.
It's an issue that could be overcome.
Absolutely. So seafood consumers, a lot of people say, well, should I just stop eating seafood? And my recommendation is no, you know, don't have a cheeseburger instead of the cod fillet, because seafood really is an amazingly healthy choice. And it's one, if we regulate it and manage it well, we can do without huge impacts in the ocean. But consumers can use these seafood purchasing guides. There are a number of organizations like the Monterey Bay Aquarium and others that put these seafood guides out, and you can follow their advice and do well by the ocean.
I have a final question about corals, and there was a study put out recently by Julia Lamb. She's formerly of Australia's James Cook University, regarding plastic debris impact on the disease and health of coral reefs. In other words, when the plastic gets on these coral reefs, it basically gives it a disease, kills it.
That's true. That was a fascinating study. Came out about a month ago in Science, the journal Science. Let's back up a little bit and talk about corals, because we haven't, and they're important. Corals are very much kind of the canary in the coal mine for the health of a global ocean. Corals, for those that have dove on them, are, you know, the rainforest of the sea, phenomenal diversity, incredible inspirational places to be. For me, it's the closest I get to, you know, church on a Sunday. But they live kind of right at the edge of their tolerance of environmental conditions. And that's particularly the case for temperature, right? So corals don't live, there are some deep water corals, but shallow warm water corals live in the tropics. That's why we visit them over spring break. And as the water has warmed, it has resulted in pushing corals beyond their thermal tolerance. And we've known for a long time that corals bleach. So if they get hot, they bleach, which means they expel the little animals that live in their tissues with them. And if they don't have enough time to recover, they can die. But the study that you referenced is a fascinating one, because it turns out that corals aren't just under threat from climate change, but from things like plastics, right? So we have known that plastics gets in, as we discussed earlier, get into the fish we eat. But nobody had really looked at, particularly in this case, across a huge expanse of geography, all the way from Australia, all the way up to Japan and into China, for the presence of plastics, and then looked at this the incidence of disease that's associated with them. And this study, I think, was really a wake-up call for coral reef biologists, but also for people like us at Ocean Conservancy that work on trying to solve the plastic problem. So the presence of plastics results in something like a 90% increase in disease incidence. That's a huge number. Right. So this isn't just like a 10% increase. It's a 20-fold increase in disease incidence, which I don't think anybody really expected and anticipated. And frankly, that's why the paper was published in Science, because they knew it was a paper that was going to be of significance to the global audience.
And when you're affecting the health of coral, it's a domino effect, since it has such a rich ecosystem involved.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about corals is not only are they these amazing oases for fish and invertebrates, but human communities depend on them deeply. And this is particularly the case, obviously, in the tropics, where a large fraction of coastal populations are dependent solely or primarily on the fish caught from coral reefs. And the big worry is that as climate change ramps up, and as the fish move to the poles, and as things like plastics, if they're not solved, we're going to have a food crisis in much of the world. So that's why getting our CO2 emissions under control, developing stronger fishery management, and working on plastics on land to keep them out of the ocean is sort of the trifecta for keeping a healthy ocean going forward.
We need to wrap up, but I want to finish on kind of a up note. You are a self-professed scuba diver. Enjoy the ocean.
Absolutely.
And you also mentioned that you have a favorite fish, or a sea creature, I should say, that you identify with in some respects.
Yes, you may have read that on the World Wide Web. I wrote a little blog at one point about sort of how I got hooked on marine science. I originally grew up on the East Coast, came to California, where I've been now for 20 years, to study kelp forests. And having grown up in New England, when I was scuba diving there as a 13 and 14-year-old, I never saw anything bigger than maybe my fist underwater, and I thought that was plenty cool. But when I went to California and I got in the water the first time, I was just blown away, first of all, by kelp plants, which are 100 feet tall, but also that there were these things called, I later found out, Pycnopodia was the scientific name, and Pycnopodia is the giant sun star. And it is a sea star, just like starfish that anybody else would think about, except it's about the size of a garbage can top at its largest, and has somewhere between 20 and 24 arms. And they're absolutely stunningly beautiful, but what they are, and typically when you think about a starfish, they just sort of sit on the bottom and they don't go anywhere. Well, I realized the first time I did a dive in a kelp forest and I found one of these things, I sat there for a moment and I noticed how this was literally running across the surface of these rocks. I could see it sort of galloping across the bottom. And it was then that I realized that, you know, invertebrates, things that aren't fish, they're not whales, they're not dolphins, but things that a lot of folks don't give a lot of credit to, can be incredibly charismatic creatures, as well as, in this case, they are a critical component of the California kelp forest system. So that's how I became a fan of the Pycnopodia and a big fan of California kelp forests, which themselves are undergoing a lot of change from many of the things we've talked about today.
Well, thank you so much, George Leonard. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Bill Barber. Joining me on the program, our science reporter and the host of Science Edition Press Conference USA is Rick Panaleo. I'm Rebecca Ward. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.